Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
By local standards, the house we grew up in on Main Street, Portlaoise, was old and rambling and ramshackle. A relic of the early 19th century fabric of that Midlands town. And with that vintage came the need for frequent and costly repairs. One winter, I was maybe 9 or 10, the sagging floor in the upstairs family room could no longer be ignored. And peeling back the carpet, my parents found a number of the ancient floorboards in an advanced stage of decomposition. The repairs, as many things in which my father had a hand, took longer than expected. But in due course, at my mother's insistence, a local workman was engaged, furniture was moved and covered with sheets, measurements were taken, mugs of tea consumed. With a jemmy bar, the old boards were lifted and the ancient newspapers that had been whispering sweet nothings to them for all those decades. McBurney's Suits for Men, Lifebuoy Soap, Guinness's Good for You, were returned to the light and promptly disintegrated in our hands like the wisdom of another era. A day or two later, the street brought to a halt outside, the jovial butcher looking on, a boyo or two smoking in the doorway of the bookie office opposite, the lengths of bright new board smelling of pitch and pine, were unloaded from a pickup, ferried in and up the narrow stairs, sawed to size, planed and sanded, and almost delicately nailed securely into place. Why exactly the carpet wasn't immediately then rolled back and the room restored to its former oldie-worldy grandeur is anybody's guess. Maybe there was a trial period to ensure the newly grafted boards would settle in. Or maybe the workman had been called away to some competing domestic emergency across town. A town even then where new builds already outnumbered the doomed museum piece homesteads such as our own. In any case, most of a week would pass before the job was finally complete. And in the interim, and this is almost impossible to exaggerate, among the worn and stained, the browned and the bruised, the weathered, almost leathered hardwood boards, there since baby Jesus was a boy, there was now this small, interloping patch, maybe 4 by 6 or 5 by 8 feet wide, of brand new, flesh-toned, smooth as a baby's bottom as our mother had it, cream-white wood. In the dark and empty theatre of that room, it was, it didn't take us long to recognise, our own purpose-built stage. And all the sheet-covered chairs and armchairs now seemed to face it, and not the sullen, sulking, bulky, monochrome television set, left dumbstruck on its sideboard perch. And being the bright sparks we were, over that week or so my siblings and I took to pacing that makeshift field of bare but never barren wood, forth and back and back and forth, crooning like Elvis, me, dancing like Pippi Longstocking, my pigtailed sister Mary, or doing robot impersonations, my brother Michael. The glare of the mantelpiece, Bakelite lamp in our eyes as we gurned and stomped, making, as our father would so often warn us not to do, a show of ourselves. Now, no week, however memorable, lasts forever. Yet even after the carpet was rolled back like a bandage to cover the wound, and after the upended chairs were inverted to stand four square again, and after the legs of the mahogany table sank back into the four dark carpet impressions that insisted on its place in the world, the truth is that in school the following week, every concrete slab in the schoolyard distinguished by rain, every stretch of the path that reached from the Boris Road back to the bicycle shed, every sunlight-blessed diamond of floor at the front of the class, for as long as the light lingered there, was transformed into nothing less than a stage. A stage on which each hesitation or movement, each slightest gesture, each word spoken or left to falter into silence, was amplified, intensified, magnified, made so much more than itself. And if my own days of wishing to be centre stage, pouting like Elvis, are mercifully gone, baby, gone, at a time when our country, our whole world, it sometimes seems, is riven by suspicion, mistrust and fear, whenever I think of those boards, the glare of that lamp, I think of a natural, essential activity for making sense of the world, of those who mask one self to allow another self be seen, who look beyond their own tidy version of the world to see what else might be out there, waiting in the wings, who remember and celebrate how old dust can be made to rise and even dance when our feet so much as cross an empty floor.
Must be lights burning brighter somewhere. Got to be birds flying higher in the sky.
As recently as Easter, we strained over cliff edges to try and spot if the sea pinks had appeared. But alas, the sheer rock bluffs that plunge into the ocean were bald and bare. Relentless rain and months of cold north winds and violent seas and low, low skies all seemed to conspire against the sea pink, ever returning. The heart clutches at such moments, hope withers, and there comes a time when you ask yourself why you continue to live in such a climate and you go to bed every night secretly dreaming of moving closer to the equator. But then, just a few weeks ago, when a heat we had forgotten suddenly rose from the ground beneath our feet, when the sky lifted and the breeze became soft with southerly promise, a speck of pink flashed defiantly from a craggy outcrop. And in the days that followed, with a blush here and a red wink there, the cliffs were transformed into a riot of colour and all was forgiven. These are the months of the sea pinks. Also known as sea thrift, the sea pink is a type of sea lavender and goes under its botanical name, Armeria maritima. Books on plants and botany tell us that the sea pink is often found growing in the northern hemisphere in salty coastal areas and has a very high tolerance of drought. This is all true, of course, but still fails to explain the sheer audaciousness of the sea pink's existence. A mighty island rock, the size of a 10-story building, stands just off our neighbourhood cliff. In an era that preceded mankind, this ground was part of the mainland, but over millennia became carved away from its continent by wild seas and furious winter's rages, and has ever since stood alone. A barren place too worn down for gulls to roost on, it is stark, cold and uninhabitable. During frequent storms, when the Atlantic is enraged, when foam blots out the sky, this desolate island is relentlessly pummeled and pounded, and its already jagged contours ceaselessly punished by the devouring ocean. And yet, as if by magic, on the recently bone-bare ridges of this gaunt stone, sea pinks are now on parade. Not just one or two of them, not just little dots of colour here and there, but glorious garlands of the flowers, festooning the naked limbs of the bleak island, broad bursts of pink that defy the torture this lonely relict of sedimentary prehistory has had to endure. Since ancient times, sea pinks have featured in literature and art, representing love, beauty and loyalty in the face of adversity. In Egypt, the flowers played a central role in burial rituals, symbolising eternal life. In Greek mythology, sea pinks are associated with Aphrodite, the goddess of love. As Aphrodite wept over the death of her lover, Adonis, her falling tears were transformed into sea pinks, the story goes. The sea pink grows in compact grass-like clumps, and its globe-shaped flowers, as the name suggests, are bright pink or occasionally white or red, and their stems are tall. The plant is also called thrift, most likely because its leaves are packed together tightly like a skinflint's wallet, which allows the plant to hoard moisture in the salt-laden air. Misers hoard coins, and the old British threepenny bit had a design of thrift on its reverse to remind us that being thrifty means making do with very little money, and to explain how the sea pink, which has to make do with very little moisture, earned its prideful place on this humble coin. These reddish-brown sea cliffs present a spectacular record of the Earth's past, of volcanoes under the sea, of arid deserts and dramatic ice ages, each era etched into the face of the precipices. The cliffs are rich in copper, a treasure from the deep subterranean from which they exploded upwards millions of years ago. Until the 19th century, this area of County Waterford was a busy centre for metal mining and is now known as the Copper Coast, and was designated Ireland's first UNESCO Global Geopark in 2015. There is only so much copper in soil that plants can live with, but the sea pink has developed its own ingenious tolerance to the mineral, which allows it to flower widely over these copper-rich cliffs. The plant somehow manages to trap the high concentrations of copper that permeated from the soil, and to then dispose of them when it sheds its decaying leaves. As we hurtle far too quickly towards the day of longest light, the sight of the sea pinks is a lesson in courage. Even in the darkest days to come, when the black skeleton of the rock will stare in at us from its unrelenting gloom, we will know that hope is not extinguished. It is just awaiting its season.
I feel guilty whenever I think of that white raffia handbag with its gold clasp and matching chain. My great Aunt Katie had asked a fellow patient to make it for me for my confirmation. I tried to look pleased, but later told Mam that there was no way I was going to wear a handbag that looked like it was made of straw. The fact that my great aunt was a patient in St. Kevin's Psychiatric Hospital on Corksley Road made the gift all the more significant, and my response all the more shameful. After much pestering and pleading, my soft-hearted parents reluctantly agreed to let me pick out a different handbag from Roach Stores on Patrick Street. In the pictures from my confirmation day, I look about 14, much older than my actual 11 years. So maybe I can put some of the blame on teenage hormones. But that's a poor excuse, really. The handbag I chose was beige to complement my bluey-green crimpling outfit and flowery hat. It was decorated with little baubles and had an elaborate plastic clasp. My poor mam stuffed the white raffia bag into her own handbag just in case we needed to make a swap during the day. The church was dark, the music solemn, and the ceremony long. I went to take a hanky from my beige handbag halfway through proceedings. Too late, I discovered that when you opened it, the plastic clasp made a sound like a gun going off. those in the congregation who'd started to nod off let out a collective gasp of horror. I kept my big flowery head down and squashed the offending bag under the kneeler. I prayed and prayed for the ground to swallow me. It didn't. When the ceremony was finally over, I sheepishly retrieved the handbag and made my way out. I still don't know how Aunt Katie managed to be there waiting for us in the church grounds. There was a frantic swapping of bags between Mam and myself, and if Aunt Katie spotted anything, she didn't let on. Thankfully, I had a chance to make some amends, as Aunt Katie was a frequent visitor to our home. My dad had a half day from work every Thursday, and he'd collect his aunt from St. Kevin's and bring her to our house for her tea. Dad and Mam never made anything of the fact that Aunt Katie spent a great deal of time in a psychiatric hospital. As kids, it was just something we accepted, like having shepherd's pie for tea on a Monday. Aunt Katie was very proper in herself, as befitted a former schoolteacher, but she was also very kind and good-living. Her sister Rita kept house for her until she passed away. Someone in St. Kevin's thought that maybe Aunt Katie could return to her own house if she had a companion who would cook and clean for her. Noreen, a fellow patient, seemed to fit the bill. The arrangement worked for a little while, but it came unstuck on one particular evening. Dad came back from Aunt Katie's house, his face ashen, his voice faltering. "Noreen thinks she's Our Lady," I heard him whisper to Mam as I eavesdropped from the landing. An ambulance had arrived to bring Noreen and Aunt Katie back to St. Kevin's, he said. The Thursday afternoon visits continued throughout my teenage years, but Aunt Katie was gradually growing frailer. She broke her hip in a fall at the hospital and never recovered. I was working in Butland's holiday camp in Mosny that summer. Dad and Mam didn't tell me about Aunt Katie's death until after the funeral. Mam was always a great storyteller and letter writer, but on this occasion it was my dad who wrote to tell me that Aunt Katie's death had been peaceful. I was glad I'd written recently to Aunt Katie, even if it was only to tell her about my job frying sausages for the holidaymakers' breakfast. Nearly 50 years on, I still have Aunt Katie's Bible. The covers have long fallen off and the pages are dog-eared, but I consult it whenever the going gets tough. St. Kevin's shut down in 2002. A fire destroyed most of the structure a few years ago, leaving it roofless and home to bats. Thankfully, the 14-acre site is now being developed by the Land Development Agency for much-needed social and affordable homes, with the hospital facades retained and restored. But when our generation is no more, who will remember those who lived and died in St. Kevin's, and those who worked so tirelessly to make their lives more bearable?
Recently, some friends and I went on a short hike. Returning home ravenous some hours later, I invited them in for a quick cup of tea. "I have a fresh batch loaf if you want something to eat," I said. "Ah, no," said friend number one. "I have to get home. A cup of tea would be lovely, though." "I'm in a rush as well," said friend number two. "And besides, I never eat white bread." "Grand so," I said. "A cup of tea it is." The two of them sat down at the kitchen table while I put the kettle on. "I haven't seen bread like that in years," said friend number one, eyeing the batch loaf in its red and yellow packaging on the kitchen worktop. "It's for my brother who lives in England," I said. "It's what he always asks for when he comes home. That and lots of butter." "Sure, I might as well have a slice, seeing as how it's here," she said. I went and got some plates, knives and the butter dish. Friend number one took the batch loaf and began to peel open the greaseproof paper wrapping. She opened back the fold, prized up the heel and eased out a slice. She laid the slice on her plate, picked up her knife, and took the lid off the butter dish. "Oh, yum," she said. "Real butter. Nothing like it." The scent of freshly baked batch loaf wafted around the table. "Have you any jam?" she asked as she dug her knife into the butter and began to spread a large yellow dollop onto her slice. Friend number two watched all this with interest. Her eyes were transfixed on the knife as it spread the butter right up to the edges of the crust in neat circular swirls. "I don't eat butter either," she announced, apropos of nothing. But her voice didn't hold the same assertion it had when she told us she never ate white bread. It may even have held a hint of regret. It really was only a matter of time. The butter spreading complete, friend number one cut the slice in two, unscrewed the lid from the blackberry jam and scooped out a large spoonful. This she spread on the curvy side of her batch slice, leaving the straight side jam free. She then cut each half slice in two, picked up one of them and bit into it. "Mmm," she said, her teeth leaving a deep semicircular curve in the butter. Friend number two shifted in her seat and sipped her tea. I, by now, was already buttering my own slice of batch loaf. As I bit into it, friend number one was reaching for a second helping. That was when friend number two cleared her throat. "Have you any marmalade?" she asked. "It's marmalade we had on it when I was a child." She picked up her knife, reached for a slice, and with a sigh of deep resignation, began to spread it with butter. A batch loaf may have a very distinctive scent, but as with Proust's Madeleine moment, it's the taste that brings the memories flooding back. The bread man arriving to our street in his horse-drawn van, the whinny of the horse, the clatter of the reins, the clip-clapping of the hooves, the mothers rushing out in their aprons, the wooden trays sliding out to display mouth-watering chocolate eclairs, cream doughnuts, Viennese whirls, and joy, the batch loaves, lined up like miniature pillows, their crust black-brown, their inside soft as thistledown. The bread man would pull the batch apart and place one loaf in my mother's outstretched hands. She'd carry it like a trophy back into the kitchen, to be sliced there and then without delay, each of us children smothering it with thick yellow butter and rushing back out onto the street to show off our bounty. The bread man's van would barely have reached the end of the street when all our batch loaf was gone. "Did bread and butter always taste this good?" my two friends wondered as we wiped the crumbs away. I assured them it did. Nothing now remained of the batch loaf, only the two heels, which nobody in our house ever wanted anyway, and usually found their way into the toaster when the day old freshness had waned. Ah, well, sure, there was nothing for it, only to go out and buy another loaf. We couldn't let my brother down now, could we?
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill-offs grey, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses.
I was an 18-year-old schoolboy when I first read A.E. Housman's poem about the cherry tree. Not yet as old as the country lad of 20 years in whose voice Housman imagined the poem, the second of the 63 poems published in his celebrated volume of 1896, a short lyric, just 12 lines long, the poem was long a staple of the secondary school curriculum on both sides of the Atlantic. Loveliest of trees, the cherry now, is hung with bloom along the bough, and stands about the woodland ride, wearing white for Eastertide. The Shropshire lad goes on to reflect that the 50 springs remaining of his biblically reckoned 70 years and 10 leave little room in which to look at things in bloom. And so he concludes, "About the woodlands I will go to see the cherry hung with snow." My high school English teacher, who doubled as the school's American football coach, sternly disapproved of a youth so melancholy, so morbid in sensibility, and pronounced that the Shropshire lad was always bellyaching, whether worrying his head about the troubled wood on Wenlock Edge, or in burdening his rue-laden heart, or elegizing an athlete dying young. Along with my classmates, I dutifully filed Houseman's cherry poem in a well-stuffed and scholastically useful mental folder of poetical theme labeled mutability, the transitoriness of life, the changes wrought by time. But now, many years later, I wonder, what can a lad, or a lass for that matter, with a mere score of years notched to the name, really know of mutability and its grim tannist mortality? At most, he or she may accept mutability as a mental concept, a thing encountered in poems and books, to be discussed at school and expounded in end-of-term exams. To the recklessly cocky confidence of youth, are not the manifold changes exacted by time always caprices that befall others, but never one's own indestructible self? How can one of 20 years feel mutability in the heart, let alone in the bones and joints, the muscles and sinews, and the odd internal organ or two? As can one for whom those 50 springs have dwindled down inexorably to 40, to 30, to 20, to 10? And as they dwindle, the heart may wonder how it will engage with Houseman's poem when one's own 80 years and 10 have dwindled to naught. For the Shropshire lad is absolutely correct in his estimation. 50 springs are indeed little room in which to behold the bursting colors of the natural world in its annual miracle of renewal and rebirth. But how much littler those 50 springs when one is looking back upon them rather than looking forward to them. As my years have dwindled, the cherry is no longer the tree that most reminds me of Houseman's poem and summons musings upon mutability and mortality. Residing as I do in Dublin suburbia, the cherry of my acquaintance is not a tree of woodland rides, but of street-side verges and countless housing estates, where the great preponderance of them are of the pink-blossomed varieties, not the snowy bloom of Houseman's cherry, wearing white for Eastertide. The tree I have come to associate with Houseman's poem is the hawthorn, the glory of an Irish May, spangling the hedgerows and hillsides in profuse clusters of snow-white blossoms, perfuming the breezes with their pungent, musky scent. And my heart leaps up whenever I behold the hawthorn in its Maytime splendor, be it a row or a copse or a single solitary thorn, and especially when encountered during my regular forays into County Wicklow for a hill walk or a woodland ramble. The cherry, as Houseman knew, is an apt tree for youth, blossoming in early spring, harbinger of all the flowering and growth to come, and ripening into plump orbs of luscious fruit, sometimes sour, sometimes sweet, but always of a tongue-tingling juiciness. The hawthorn, I suggest, is a tree for maturity. Its blossoming announces the mutation of spring into summer, and come the further mutation of autumn, it bears on its boughs an abundance of the eponymous haws, spare of flesh and tart on the tongue, tiny specks of crimson color arrayed before the eye, like drops of blood splattered amid the thorns of life. It was 2 years ago in the spring that I came to the end of the 80 years and 10 allotted by the celestial referee. This spring I have entered my 3rd year of added time. But the hawthorn still blooms this month of May, as it will bloom in every May to come, as long as my eyes are open to behold it, and then beyond. And so, as I ramble the Wicklow hills and glens, I voice a reply to A.E. Houseman and his Shropshire lad, a verse reply, voiced by one of elder years, the voice, if you will, of a Wicklow geezer. Lushest of trees, the hawthorn now is hung with leaves along the bough, and stands throughout the countryside, wearing white for Whitsuntide. Now of my 70 years, none will ever come again. When 70 years have passed to yore, how many springs remain in store? And since to look at things in bloom, unreckoned springs before me loom, about the hills I yet will go to see the hawthorn hung with snow.
On this morning's programme we heard Making a Show of Ourselves by Pat Boren, Sea Pink was by Peter Cunningham, The White Raffia Handbag by Mary Hassett, The Batch Loaf was by Maeve Edwards, and A Wicklow Geezer by Lawrence White. The music this morning was If I Can Dream by Elvis Presley, Open the Door Softly by Archie Fisher, performed by Donal Clancy. Someone to Watch Over Me was by George Gershwin and played by Coleman Hawkins. And Bread and Roses, sung by Dawn Landes, Alana Amran and Abigail Chapin. And a live event you might be interested in. Sunday Miscellany returns to the Belfast Book Festival next month with guests including Jan Carson, Paul McVeigh, Glenn Patterson and John Toll. That's Sunday Miscellany at the Belfast Book Festival on the afternoon of Sunday the 9th of June at the Crescent Arts Centre in Belfast. For tickets, go to crescentarts.org. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back to this morning's programme on the RTE Radio app or at the programme website, rte.ie/radio/radio1/Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.